Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. My name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. On Tuesday, the 25th November 2003, 52-year-old Anthony John Hardy pleaded guilty to the brutal murders of Sally Rose White, Elizabeth Selina Vallad, and Bridget Cathy McClellan. Three sex workers whose only connection was the money they needed for the drugs that they used. The barbaric nature of their deaths, the disposal of their bodies, and the sadistic callousness with which he abused their corpses shocked a nation to its very core. And in an instant, this anonymous nobody gained infamy, being dubbed the Camden Ripper. But as fast as he became famous, he was forgotten. It seems strange that so little is written about him. But then again, very little is known. As although he craved the cruel limelight which his infamous hero once courted, he could be as cheery and chatty as any civilized member of society one minute, and a blank, expressionless wall of nothingness the next. Giving nothing to the police?
No comment.
The lawyers?
No comment.
Or the psychiatrist.
No comment.
The truth about the Camden Ripper may never be known, as the details are vague, the timings may be sketchy, and even the most solid pieces of evidence only led to the best guesses by experts. So it's hard to understand who he is, as he appeared to be a different person to different people at different times. But by viewing this story from his perspective, it is clear that there were four distinct sides to the personality of Anthony Hardy. The alcoholic, the addict, the sadist, and the maniac. These are the four faces of the Camden Ripper. Part 1. Tony the Alcoholic.
Over the last decade or so, I've been prone to binge drinking. Cider, wine, vodka, you name it. Although I wouldn't really call myself an addict. It's a crutch I use for when I'm low. That night, I drunk till I could drink no more. I'd filled the fridge beforehand to make sure it was properly stocked. But I don't know how much I drank. I blacked out. All I remember after that is being in a police cell.
Saturday the 19th of January 2002. The date is correct. The time is unspecified, but it's definitely late. And Anthony Hardy, known as Tony, is standing in the borough of Camden, near King's Cross Station. A ceaseless cesspool of sin, bathed in the sickening neon glow of takeaways, taxi ranks, arcades, bars, B&Bs, and the dull red glow of sleazy brothels. It's a transient place, where the sensible get out as quick as they get in. But the desperate get stuck, as the lost are lured by the promise of sex, drugs, and drink. To some, it's terrifying. But for Tony, Each and every street has been his home for the last 12 years. Whether under a roof, a doorway, or a cardboard box. But now he's doing okay. Not great, just okay. Standing an impressive 6 foot and 1 inch tall and 19 stone. Although larger than most, he's often mistaken for being bigger than he actually is, owing to his bold persona, his big bushy grey beard, and the mass of dark thick layers which he wears to keep out the incessant drizzle and biting winter wind. Dressed from head to toe in black, from his NY baseball cap to his shin-length coat, the only flashes of colour are his white smile, his gaudy Hawaiian shirt, and a set of amusing cartoon socks. And although he stands out, he also blends in. As formerly being a man of no fixed abode, he's used to being a nobody to the average person, who only ever converses with the police and social services. Far from being the man he used to be, educated, married, skilled, and employed, over the last 2 years, he's tried to turn his life around, even going so far as to get his own council flat just a few roads away. But every day has been a daily struggle, and only being 6 days out of detox, he's relapsed again. He isn't staggering or slurring, as being intoxicated is his normal. So clutching a bag of booze and being single, like most nights, he's here in the seedy recesses of King's Cross, looking for sex. Tony's story is a tragically familiar one for many of the lost souls living on London streets. And that night, like any other, he was unable to think of anything else but fueling his addictions. Summer, 1989. Just shy of 40, a thinner, less grey Tony drove a slightly battered Ford Sierra through the back streets of the city. Just out of a Norwich prison, on his second stint for reckless driving, criminal damage, and being drunk and disorderly, although disqualified, he used illegal minicabbing to pay his way. Over the last decade, the life of this husband, father of four, and middle-class engineer had collapsed. Being little more than a washed-up ex-con who lived in a cheap squalid bedsit, being divorced, depressed, and separated from his teenage kids, he drank heavily and lost what little he still had. His first 25 years started well enough, but growing increasingly restless, agitated and angry, Tony was hospitalised for 10 days in April 1982 at the Park Centre, a psychiatric facility in Brisbane, where he was diagnosed with depression, marked by violent outbursts and exacerbated by drinking. From that day onwards, Tony became a familiar face in London's detox centres, help groups, homeless hostels, and psychiatric wards, where he was diagnosed with manic depression, for which he was prescribed lithium, but he also self-medicated with alcoholic binges and cannabis. Drinking up to 6 litres of Frosty Jack cider a day, being a big man, sometimes the booze just dulled the edges of his anxiety. And other times, he drank until he blacked out. In 1992, given his size and alcohol intake, Tony was diagnosed with diabetes. His mobility worsened, his weight increased, and it drastically lessened his sexual function, but not his libido. That same year, his younger brother Barry took his own life. And Tony hit rock bottom, and his life got worse. Evicted from a series of hostels for assaults on its residents and staff, and having been booted out of the Arlington House Hotel by a court of law, Tony found a bed in the Ferndale Hotel, a homeless refuge at 41 Argyle Square in King's Cross, but by then, his mental health had severely deteriorated. On the 30th of April 1995, gripped by the delusion that he was a wanted killer and seeing a police van parked outside his window, Tony dived into the back and insisted on being arrested for his crimes. Seen by the duty psychiatrist at University College Hospital, he said he was hearing voices, and a urine test concluded that he was in the midst of a drug-induced psychosis. It was a major psychotic episode, but his mental collapse would get him the help that he so badly needed. From the 2nd to the 5th of May 1995, Tony was a voluntary inpatient at the Huntley Centre at St Pancras Hospital, where he was assessed, diagnosed, medicated, and assigned a care worker from the focus team, who helped him to register with a GP, find support groups, and assisted with temporary accommodation, so his life could return to some kind of normality. But the next 4 years would be even tougher. Evicted from the Ferndale Hotel, on the 30th of August 1995, Tony took an overdose and was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. On the 3rd of October, being arrested for public indecency, Tony was sectioned again and readmitted to the Huntley Centre, this time for 3 months spent on the Mornington unit. During his hospitalisation, he was arrested twice for drunkenness and criminal damage to the ward. During Tony's stay, a psychiatrist with the North London Forensic Service wrote two reports about his alcohol abuse, stating, Tony uses alcohol when feeling depressed and to cope with life stresses. It does not always indicate early signs of a manic episode. Only Tony had many outlets for his anger. One was alcohol, one was cannabis, and the other was sex. Diagnosed as bipolar in January 1996, Tony was given a long-term bed at Argyle Walk, a hostel for the homeless with mental health needs, where he stayed until May 1997, when the focus team secured him a supportive living space at 34 King's Terrace. Unlike a hostel, King's Terrace was a self-contained flat which offered him better support but greater independence. And having stability, he flourished. His care worker stated, "There have been no episodes of psychosis or hospitalization. His mood has remained fairly consistent, if somewhat subdued. He's doing his own shopping, cooking, and is keeping himself active to minimize isolation. Mr. Hardy's stability at Argyle Walk cannot be overstated." But his alcoholism and mental health would always be a struggle, and feeling that his life lacked independence. On the 10th of May 1998, he was arrested for assault, sectioned, and on the 6th of August, that very same year, he was sectioned again and hospitalised in the Cardigan ward at St Luke's Psychiatric Hospital. It was a blip in his recovery, but with a renewed focus to get a home of his own, across the next year, he fought to turn his life around. On the 3rd of June 1999, Camden Council offered him a flat. And on the 20th of January 2000, Tony Hardy became the legal tenant of 4 Heartland in Camden. To Anthony Hardy, this was his home. But to his 3 victims, it would become a house of horrors. Heartland was a brown brick and white-walled 4-storey council block on the College Place estate, bordered by College Place, Plender Street, and a short walk from the canal and King's Cross. Cheaply constructed in pre-assembled concrete shells and connected by several stairwells, they're simple, affordable, and to the left of the ground floor stairwell, behind a black front door, sat flat number 4. Kept in an orderly state of disarray, it was neither filthy nor stylish, as everything was basic, practical, and had its own place. Up front was a multicoloured living room, dominated by a blue sofa, 3 tellies, a pile of true crime books, a coffee table with a neat stack of VHS tapes, and a few feet behind sat his double bed. He had a small grubby kitchen, a grimy little bathroom, and a spare room filled with some furniture should he ever have a friend over to stay, as well as his photographic equipment and his junk. Decorated using a misjudged mix of garish colours and marker pens, almost every wall, ceiling and door was covered in an ad hoc array of indecipherable art by Tony. But they weren't the intricate designs of a skilled engineer, but the doodles of a childlike mind. As if to keep his bad thoughts at bay, the walls were a brightly coloured mural of love, happiness and spirituality, consisting of everything from fishes, pets, faces, names, seas and stars to Celtic crosses. It was like a daily reminder to be happy. On the 7th of August 2001, a full assessment was undertaken, and although alcohol was his main risk, he had joined an art class, a support group, he had cut down his drinking to just 2 pints a day, he maintained a 10-year relationship with his good friend Maureen Reeves, who he would regularly meet with for a cup of tea, as she listened to his fascinating theories about the infamous serial killer Jack the Ripper. And by September, his care worker had stated that he was being effectively managed in the community. Within his bubble, he was blossoming. But out on the estate, he was struggling. Seen as a bit of a weirdo, who dressed in black, muttered to himself, and only ever socialised with sex workers. After a decade living on the streets, he was unused to dealing with the simple everyday problems of life. In November 2001, with his neighbour's bath in the upstairs flat leaking down into his, unable to even discuss it with her, he got anxious, depressed, and proceeded to binge drink. And although he couldn't recall his actions owing to an alcoholic blackout, he bent her car's windscreen wipers and slashed her tyres. The problem was finally resolved and the leak was fixed. But for the weeks afterwards, he seethed. On the 7th of January 2002, Tony voluntarily entered Rugby House, an alcoholic detox clinic in Bermondsey by London Bridge Station. But unable to quit his main addiction, he discharged himself just 6 days later. By Saturday the 19th of January, just shy of midnight, he was standing in King's Cross Station.
That night, I drunk till I could drink no more. I'd filled the fridge beforehand to make sure it was properly stocked. But I don't know how much I drank. I blacked out. All I remember after that is being in a police cell.
With a bag of booze in his hand and his flat a few streets away, focused only on fueling his addictions, Tony needed sex. And the girl he chose was Sally. Born on the 23rd of September 1963, Sally Rose White was the youngest daughter of Arthur and Muriel, a loving couple who strived to give her all of the support she needed, having been born with brain damage. Educated at a special needs school, although a struggle, Sally had an idyllic upbringing, being raised by the Quay in the coastal town of Poole in Dorset, where she thrived and got a job as a shop assistant. But as she entered her 20s, being little more than a child in an adult's body, whose independence was limited to protect her, she became aggressive, repeatedly ran away from home and slept rough. In 1991, age 28, Sally gave birth to a daughter called Louise. But unable to care for her baby, she was given up for adoption. Relenting to her request to live her life as she wanted, Sally moved to London as her worried parents supported her from a distance. But having refused their help, she began to struggle. She lost her job, her flat, and becoming homeless, she funded her crack addiction with sex work. As a sweet, naive, and easily led girl, she had no idea how vulnerable she was, being just an innocent little fish who swam in a dark, turbulent sea of hungry sharks. In her final months, her father often scoured the many homeless hostels of London, seeking to bring his baby home. But Sally always refused. On the cold, wet morning of Saturday the 19th of January 2002, being a little dot with a sweet smile, twinkly brown eyes and jet black hair, wearing blue jeans, a blue jacket and a grey hoodie, 38-year-old Sally was last seen at the Manor Centre in Melia Street in Bermondsey, a charity by London Bridge Station which provides food, beds and support for the city's most vulnerable. Like so many, Sally was a familiar face. As was Tony, who just 6 days earlier had discharged himself from detox just one street away. Whether he knew her from the hostels, whether they first met that day, or whether he had picked her up in King's Cross as one of hundreds of sex workers he had procured across his life is unknown. All we know is that they were both vulnerable, needy, and desperate. For both, this seemed like a win-win situation, as she was sweet and petite, and he was charming and fatherly. So just shy of midnight, clutching a bag of booze, they both walked back to his warm, cozy flat to feed their addictions. It was an ordinary night, as inside the brightly coloured living room at 4 Heartland, Sally sat alongside Tony on the blue sofa, where they supped cheap wine, chatted about true crime, got warm, ate, and had a bit of a giggle. Later, as his diabetes made sex a little unpredictable, Tony popped a porno in his VHS player, and when that familiar feeling stirred in his loins, he led Sally to bed. Not his bed behind the sofa, as this was his private space, and he hated messing up his neat blue bedsheets, his stack of medications, and his Space Invaders t-shirt drying on the radiator. So instead, he led her to the spare room. Having folded her jacket and jeans neatly on the floor, dressed in just a bra, pants and hoodie, Sally lay on the bed. Bearing down on top of this small 9-stone girl was the towering naked bulk of a 19-stone man. With 6 litres of cider inside him, a temperamental erection, and a thirst for rough sex. At 4 a.m, a neighbour later stated that they heard a scream. But that could have been anything. The next morning, although the little issue of his neighbour's leaky bath had been resolved back in December, Tony was still fuming. Having previously snapped her wipers, slashed her tyres, and sent her an abusive letter after she found him rummaging through her bins, none of which he could recall, being openly hostile and unable to confront her, as she slept, he vandalised her front door. At 6:40 a.m. on Sunday the 20th of January 2002, alerted by the neighbour, Sergeant Nick Spinks arrived at the first floor flat at 10 Heartland. The damage was obvious. With a plastic cider bottle, a liter of sulfuric acid from an abandoned car battery had been poured through a letterbox. Across the white door, in black paint, were sprayed the words, "Fuck you, slut, you're a cunt." And as if there was no denying who had done this cowardly, petulant deed, the culprit had signed it with the letter T. And as the bubbling acid pulled at the base of the door, the prints of his size 11 trainers led from her door to his. Tony was not happy to see the officers. And although he smelt of drink, not being intoxicated, he fully admitted to the charge of criminal damage and asked to be escorted to the police station. Finding his enthusiasm to be detained elsewhere a little suspicious, with Tony's consent, they searched his flat. They found the cider bottle, the funnel, and a can of black spray paint. Every room was checked, except for the spare room, which Tony stated was sublet to a lady, and he didn't have the key. So with him being calm and fully compliant, he was arrested for the minor offence of criminal damage. Before being led outside into the freezing cold morning, sensibly, Tony asked if he could pop on a coat. And removing the anorak which hung on the back of his door, the officer searched it first. In the lining, he found a key. The key fitted the locked door. And suddenly, Tony began to sweat as they entered the spare room. With the window locked from the inside, the police knew that no one had entered or exited that room since they had arrived. To the side of the wardrobe, a set of folded clothes had been stashed. On the floor lay a grey hoodie, and tossed on the red rug, a pair of bra and pants had been cut into pieces. The room was messy and cluttered, but no more than the rest of the flat, and nothing looked damaged or broken. Above the pillow, a circle of blood marked the point where a head had impacted with the white wall, and leading down to the bed, a dark-haired lady silently lay. Being naked and lying spread eagle with her legs splayed wide, she was still warm to the touch. And although a blue towel masked her face, with her skin pale, her cheeks mottled, and her lips a bluish hue, it was clear that Sally was dead. Inside her grey hoodie, a sticky mess matched the mass of matted hair on her head's bloody crown. And besides a few bruises, the only other injury was a bite mark to the inside of her right thigh, which matched Tony's teeth. By the bed, he had placed a bucket of warm soapy water and a yellow sponge. As being disturbed by the police, perhaps out of panic, Tony had tried to cover up this accident. Trembling and pale, Tony was arrested for criminal damage, suspicion of murder, and taken to Kentish Town Police Station. As was his right, he replied,
"No comment,"
to every question, had no recollection of the incident, and he made the officers aware of his alcoholism, diabetes, and mental health issues. For the detectives, it seemed like a pretty solid case of murder or manslaughter, with Tony as the only suspect. He had concealed the body, lied about the key, attempted a clean-up, and the only DNA or fingerprints other than hers which was found at the scene was his. He had a history of alcoholism, psychosis, delusions, and violence. And all of his neighbours described him as a nutter, a weirdo, and a loner. On the 22nd of January 2002, while on remand pending his trial for murder, Tony was found guilty of criminal damage and assessed by the psychiatric diversion team at Highbury Corner Magistrates Court. being described as downcast, depressed, and on the verge of tears. They confirmed that he was fit to stand trial, but stated, Mr. Hardy currently presents in a fragile state. He's still suffering from alcohol withdrawal and depressive and suicidal thoughts, consequent to the situation which he finds himself in. Transferred to Pentonville Prison and put on suicide watch. On the 12th of January 2002, Tony was sectioned under the Mental Health Act and readmitted to the Mornington Psychiatric Unit at the Huntley Centre. But for the police, having completed a thorough investigation, this murder case was a done deal. Or at least, it should have been. On the 15th of April 2002, at St Pancras Coroner's Court, the Home Office pathologist Dr. Freddie Patel gave his findings. The autopsy found no evidence of poisoning or assault. The bite mark, bruising and abrasions to her skin were not regarded as marks of violence. And although her head wound was consistent with a blunt impact with a broad hard surface like a wall, having possibly occurred owing to a stumble or collapse, the wound had not caused her death. Born with a defective heart, Dr. Patel stated that her cardiovascular system showed a severe coronary atheroma with a 40 to 60% occlusion in the proximal anterior branch. In short, she had died of heart failure during rough sex. Listed as death by natural causes, the coroner concluded that the police have conducted an investigation, and although it is obvious that Mr. Hardy is in need of psychiatric treatment, there is no evidence to suggest that he was responsible for the death of Sally Rose White. The trial took less than 15 minutes. The police were not asked to give evidence, and although they took a very rare step of requesting that a second autopsy be conducted, Dr. Freddie Patel returned with the same conclusion: heart failure. The murder case collapsed, the charges were dropped, and although he had been committed to a psychiatric unit, Anthony John Hardy was cleared of murder. The truth about the Camden Ripper may never be known, and it's hard to understand who he is, as he appeared to be a different person to different people at different times. But by viewing the story from his perspective, it was clear that there were four distinct sides to the personality of Anthony Hardy: the alcoholic, the addict, the sadist, and the maniac. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Part 2 of this 4-part series into the Camden Ripper continues next week. But if you'd like to know more about this case, stay tuned for some extra tidbits, as well as a quiz, a bicky, and a cup of tea with me. Before that, a big thank you to my new Patreon supporter, who is Kate Wakefield. I thank you very much. As well as a thank you to Simon Monks and Mel for your very kind donations via the supporter link in the show notes. Shares in McVitie's and Mr. Kipling have gone through the roof as I plunder the shelves for cake to stock up for Christmas. Although, let's be honest, they probably won't last until Christmas. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Oh, it felt longer. Felt like that felt longer than... Oh, dear. It wasn't too bad, but it felt a lot longer. Oh, dear Lord. Oh, God. It's too early. Because it's a Saturday, I decided to wake up early because it's... Because even though the canals get really busy, because people are like, oh, I need to go for a walk. And you get all the people out jogging and crap like that. So I decided to get up early to do it. And then I realised the seagulls wake up early as well. So I've been battling with the seagulls on this. Right, okay. Let me go and put on my cup of tea. And then we'll get down to the biz. We'll get down to the biz of the biz. The business. The big biz of business. Oh, look, it's daylight now. Cripes, when did that happen? Cup of tea on. Do you want one? Shall I make you a cup of tea? Shout out now. I can't hear you. Can't hear you. Can't hear you, no, can't hear you. Oh, well, I can't make you a tea then. What shall I have? Shall I have a quaffy? Quaffy! Quaffy o'clock. Here we go. Right. Instant coffee. Bit of sucre. There we go. And powdered milk. Powdered milk. Only because I would buy proper milk, but... The Lidl near me only seems to do it in 2 litre jugs. They don't seem to do the little one, which really annoys me. I could still do... I've got some Angel Delight. I could do a big bowl of Angel Delight today. That'd be good. Anyway, what's going on? Getting into winter now, so the fire's on. That's good. Started putting my fire on. Mr. Nicholas. All right, la. Thank you very much, Mr. Nicholas. A friend of mine sent me some night logs, which is very nice. Bit of a surprise when I got to my P.O. box. And they went, you got a parcel? And I went, I'm not expecting one. Okay. And they went, be careful, it's a bit heavy. And I looked and it was 25 kilos of logs. And I was like, shit, how am I going to carry these home? But I did. I made it home. I put them in 3 bags and I carried them home. And they're great. They're night logs. You put them in the fire late at night and they keep it just ticking over till the morning, which is great. So they're really good. I bought some coffee logs because, you know, burning wood isn't, you know, that environmentally friendly, but there's some logs made from coffee granules which are good and they smell really nice as well, so I'm using some of those. So I'm all ready for winter. And the fire is on, not at the moment, but it's still warm from last night, and I've been roasting chestnuts and doing marshmallows, so that's been very nice. What else is going on? Pretty much everything is sorted with all mum and grand stuff, which is good. That has been a very stressful year trying to get that done. Phew, the legal stuff is a killer, isn't it? I know many of you will have dealt with this before, but it's a killer, isn't it? It's like someone passes away and you think that's the hard bit done. You think, oh, that was stressful, and you know, you do the funeral and then it's all that. But it's all the legal stuff after that, and all of a sudden you realise, you know, if you don't sort your stuff out beforehand, which is what me and my brother and sister are doing now, we're sorting out our lives and kind of putting things on paper. So if anything happens to us, we've all got a piece of paper that says, right, this is what you do. And I know my dad's already got one because he showed me years ago. He was like, if anything happens to us, it's in our drawer, everything you need to know. Which is, I think that's a good way. So when, you know, if anything happens to any of us, you just get a piece of paper and you go, okay, I can go here, do that, check that, done. Grand stuff and mum stuff, where I'm to go through all the paperwork. Oh, it's been a nightmare. Anyway, it's almost done, thank God. We're still in the lockdown two here at the moment. Lockdown two, electric boogaloo. And next week we go into tier two. Whatever that means. Oh, everyone's looking at around at each other going, oh, shit. Everyone's looking around at each other going, what is tier two? Sorry, my computer switched off for a second then. Everyone's looking around at each other going, what is tier two? What does it mean? And it's like, we've looked at the lists and everyone's still slightly confused. I know it's meant to be more clarity for everyone, but I don't think it is. I don't think it's more clarity here. Anyway, makes a difference to me. I live in my own special little lockdown anyway, so next week will be no different. I'll be churning out more episodes of Murder Mile. What else? This series, I hope you enjoyed that first episode. It's something different. It's been a hard one to write because I'm trying to do it in a very different way. It's one of these things where I thought to myself, yeah, like a year ago, year and a half ago, I thought, yeah, let's try and do Anthony Hardy. Because there's not a lot written about him, and I thought that'd be quite interesting to do. And then I realised that no one has written anything about him because there's nothing written. There's pieces out there. There's a lot of tabloid crap. And what I've spent the last year doing is double-checking everything. And the bulk of the stuff that's out there is dog shit. Absolute dog shit. No, there's no books written about him. There's one or two that are out there, and they are just utter shit. Literally like a couple of pages long, or like he appears in a couple of chapters, and even those are dog shit as well. So I thought, wow, this is going to be difficult. There's no archive files as well. Luckily his mental health inquiry was available, so I was able to use that. And then I've just spent the year compiling different pieces and building basically a Bible to do. I had to use the word Bible when you connect to Anthony Hardy, but you know, a Bible is in a kind of a big comprehensive guide, and I've done a chronology of his life, and I've broken it down to literally in some day places, it's like days, months, even down into minutes as well, of where he is, to try and cross-reference everything to make sure everything's correct and where he was, and then going in and like going, okay, the hoodie was grey, or you know, the bed clothes were green, and you know, having to do all that, just literally little details to try and get it right. But I think it's made for a nice four-part series. So just to say, if you listen to this episode and you're like, oh, I know this case, blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, oh, Michael's missed out some details there, and you're like preparing an email now to say, you've missed out these details. Don't. This is specifically written in a very specific way. So you'll get it as you go through the series, but it's Anthony Hardy in four different parts. So you see his perspective on different parts of... It'll make sense when you get through it. So that's part one. So that's the case there, but... been really difficult to write because there's things that I want to tell you and things that I can't tell you yet, because it leads into part two or it leads into part three. So you know, his alcoholism in part one plays in part two, but then his use of sex workers plays into part three, and then some of the things he's done lead into part four. And then when you start getting episodes 2, 3, and 4 together, then you go back and listen to one, and then you're like, oh, that, okay, that I see. It's that kind of, you know, I'm deliberately hiding things in different places, and I'm deliberately telling you things, and I'm deliberately kind of half telling you things. So I'm giving you all the details, but then I'm not at the same time. So I'm having fun with it, but it's I think it's an interesting way of trying to work out who he is, because there is no way of working out who he is. And tea's up. Oh, great. Oh, I did a coffee. I've done a coffee. I've done a go-go. So that's all interesting. And then, bloody sod's law. Oh, I couldn't have waited. Last night it was announced. Spoilers! Last night it was announced that Anthony Hardy had passed away. That he died in a hospital. So that was slightly annoying, because I was like, oh, I'm really gearing up for this. Like, really gearing up to get all my episodes ready. And if he would have died next week, or when... you hear this, that would have been great, but he died yesterday, which is really annoying. So it hasn't really hit the papers yet. To be honest, most people don't care about him, so no one really gives a shit. But I'm sure there'll be a lot of podcast episodes going out of people rushing and using Wikipedia to do an episode there's nothing on Wikipedia, and the stuff that's out there is shit. So people are going to send you the same shite. Sorry, my computer keeps switching off. This is really annoying. People are probably going to do you a couple of cheapy one-part episodes out there about Anthony Hardy, but this has taken me a year to get this right. So I hope you enjoy this. It's a complicated one. It requires four episodes. It really does to get it right. What else is there? If you're a Patreon subscriber, there's loads of new extra stuff that's going to be on there. I'm going to be into town this week filming some extra stuff, so I will film you the locations as well. There's quite a few locations and some previously unreleased things that I found as well, so I hope you enjoy that. What else is there? I think that's it. Oh, last week I witnessed a shooting. Oh, yeah. That was interesting. I was up with my iPad at the tube station. And I was downloading all my programs, trying to download the final for Bake Off still, which he won't bloody download. So don't tell me who's won. I don't care. I hope it's what's his face? Peter. I hope Peter won, because he's the only one who really deserved to be in the final. I think Dave with wobbly shoulders, he's made too many mistakes. And Laura's nice, but she's not good enough. It should have been Lottie. Let's agree. It should have been Lottie. It should have been Peter. It should have been Ermine, who was excellent. And the guy with the stubbly beard, who was really good. I thought he was really good. It should have been those four, really. But you can't have everything. Anyway, to people who don't watch Bake Off, anyway. I witnessed a shooting, which was weird. I was up at the tube station. I was downloading all my programs on the iPad. I've now been banned from downloading programs on the iPad in the tube station. And then there were five shots. I looked across the street and a young man had been shot and was lying in the street. And I was like, what the F is going on? This is Britain. We don't have stuff like that. We have gentlemen's arguments where people are poisoned or, you know, things like that, or dueling. You know, you don't have twats with guns. Anyway, yeah, someone got shot. Very exciting. It's weird. The sound of a gun going off doesn't sound like a gun going off. It's weird. Like they always say, the sounds never sound like you think that they would. But this was... It sounded more like someone getting a very heavy doormat and banging it outside to get rid of the dust. It sounded more like that. It was weird. It was a weird echo to it. So whether it was some type of gun... Don't forget, in this country, we don't really have a lot of new guns. We have a lot of the... The problem is our country is flooded by start of World War II, because we had no guns, because we don't have a gun culture. We got a load of secondhand guns from America, because obviously America has an excess of guns. So their spare ones were sent over here. And then at the end of the war, there's a big gulp of them, like tons and tons of them are actually dumped in the Channel. So there's loads of them dumped in the Channel, but unfortunately quite a lot of them didn't actually make it to there. People kept them as souvenirs, and the problem is people keep them as souvenirs and then they sell them off and then they deactivate them and then it's easy to reactivate them. So we've got a lot of antique guns, or kind of ones from 1920s, 30s and 40s, which are still being used today, so they're pretty lethal. Anyway, guns, eh? Right, people, cake of the day. Went to Lidl yesterday, treated myself, because obviously yesterday we sorted out all the mum and grand stuff. So after the stress of that, I thought I'd have a treat, and I treated myself to a chocky donut. Lovely chocky donut with chocolate sprinkles on top. So I've got two there. I can have those shortly. Right, let's do a quiz. Core, my head hurts. Right, quiz time. I'm probably going to balls up some of these. So question number one. Just checking how much we've done an extra mile. Right, question number one. Get ready, everyone. Question one. Sally and Tony. What were their middle names? Oh, it's a two-parter. Oh, exciting. Look at that. Oh, two-parter. Ooh. Sally and Tony, what were their middle names? Question number two. How much... I paused then because I thought I'd miswritten the question. Question two. How much did Tony state that he drank each day? So how much did Tony drink each day? You can give yourself a bonus point if you can name his favourite cider. That was another little bit of research by me. It's not written down there, but I did my usual research of going 7.5% cider, and we know it was in 2-litre bottles, so I went searching and I guessed it would be this one anyway. Question number three. Tony was on 7 prescription drugs. Which one was he on for depression? I mentioned this earlier in the episode. Question number 4. Who is Tony's... Shouldn't we? Who was Tony's serial killer hero? Question number 5. How many tellies did Tony have? So how many tellies in his front room did Tony have? You can take a guess at that one. Question number 6. What was the name of the supported living accommodation that Tony got before he moved into his flat in Heartland? Oh, can you remember that one? Question 7. Why did Tony jump out of a window at the Ferndale Hotel? Question number 8. What were some of the things that Tony painted on his walls and doors? In the later episodes, we're really going to go into the fine details about his flat. I've given you a basic overview now, but it's fascinating and it gives you an insight into his mind. So that's going to crop up again. There's a lot of things that I've kind of glossed over in this episode because I know we're going to go into them fully later on. But it's all about perspective in this. This is interesting because I've been desperate to write an episode where you see things from the difference, same thing from a different perspective. For ages, and then I was like, oh, this is the episode where I can do that. Question 9. What was Sally's daughter's name, who she put up for adoption? And question 10. What country did Tony previously live in and spent time in a psychiatric ward? That was early in the episode. Do you remember? Oh, that coffee's too hot. Right, cool. I'm going to try and give you some extra stuff or go through some of the stuff that we've already done. But what I'm going to try and do is not mess up the quiz, but also try and not mess up the episodes as well. So obviously, Tony had many kind of mental health episodes, as they called it, throughout the series. The ones that were listed here, there's a lot more. When we go to episode 4, we'll really be diving into kind of the violence of his past. So in this episode, I've really been very careful on what I've kind of told you in here, because there are things that I don't want to tell you yet because they're more important later on. I want you to see him as a sympathetic character, as an alcoholic here. And then, because when you start with him sympathetically and then you see part 4, you get to that episode, what I want you to do is go, wow, okay, who is he? Who is he? And this is why it's hard to pin down who he is, because he's very different to different people. He's a very different character. I don't think he's schizophrenic. I think he is. I'm not going to give too much away. I think hopefully in across the episodes you'll kind of come to your own conclusion, because there is no real conclusion here. And there definitely isn't now, because he's dead. So we'll just try and dive into a couple of things here. Oh, this is one of the questions, so I don't know whether I can give away too much of this. I'll skimp on it. 30th of April 1995, this was one of the episodes he had. He was admitted as a voluntary patient initially at the University College Hospital on Gower Street. Gower Street, the University Hospital, that's where Dr. Spilsbury was based. Obviously, Spilsbury died 50 years before. Tony Hardy was... If you notice in this episode, I call him Tony. It's very deliberate. Because everyone calls him Anthony Hardy, but all his friends called him Tony. So deliberately in this episode, I call him Tony to make you like him a little bit more. It's good fun, right? Writing someone who's horrible, but writing him sympathetically, it's good fun. As mentioned, he was homeless at the time, drinking, using a lot of cannabis. As mentioned, he'd jumped out of his window at the Ferndale Hotel. I'm not going to explain why, because that's one of the questions. Well done, me. The police, quite rightly, took him to A&E, and he was ranting and raving. They said he was clearly psychotic. They weren't sure whether it was drug-induced. But when he got there, he seemed to be presenting quite well. The records say he was taken to accident and emergency at St Pancras Hospital initially, where he was interviewed by a psychiatrist and was therefore admitted as a voluntary patient at the hospital psychiatric unit. Interesting, the psychiatric unit is one street away from his home. It's literally within spitting distance. You can see the ward from his house. He was seen by the duty psychiatrist, and they said when he presented there, he was nearly mute with his head in his hands. When he did speak, his speech was tangential and abnormal in form. The following day, he admitted to hearing voices of people saying they would beat him up. He also said that he was communicating with the television. He had a history of heavy drinking and a urine screen. Sorry, that was a burp then. And a urine screen said that he was positive for cannabis, and this was diagnosed as a drug-induced psychosis. So this was the first time that he was referred to the Huntley Centre. Two names that we've put in here, the Huntley Centre, which is at St Pancras Hospital, the Mornington unit. Sorry, there's three names in there. The Mornington unit is in the Huntley Centre, which is in the St Pancras Hospital. They like to make it difficult. So that's there. We're going to come back to that again soon. And then you've also got the Cardigan unit, which is at St Luke's Psychiatric Hospital. That will appear later on as well. So these are two important names to remember for the next week, but I'll remind you about that, don't worry. So that was his first time committed to that ward. But from that point, that was quite good. He'd been on the streets for about 5 years. They said he got no community support, so he was kind of living homeless off his own wits. He hadn't got a doctor. So from this point onwards, they were able to kind of get him sorted out. It must be horrible if you're homeless, because, you know, what do you do? You can't get a job because you don't have a place to live. You don't have an address. You can't get references. Do you know, you probably don't have a bank account. Do you know, I guess when you're in that hole, you can't get out of the hole because it's so difficult. So he'd been homeless for quite a long time. I mean, he'd definitely been homeless since about 90, but he might have been homeless in kind of the late part of the 80s as well. There's a big chunk of his life, which we'll go into in part four, where it's uncertain where he is and what he was doing. We know he was definitely doing some illegal minicabbing, and we'll learn more about his early part of his life as well. I'm going to avoid that bit, so I'm being very careful not to give too much away. As mentioned, 30th of August 1995, he had a major overdose. They didn't say of what, whether it was on his prescription medications or... because he was on cannabis, but, it's hard to really overdose on cannabis, really, unless he was on something lethal, like some kind of lethal skunk or something, but skunk weed. If anyone's from Brixton who's listening to this, you'll know Skunk Weed Man, who's outside Brixton Station. Skunk Weed. Was I walked past him once, and he looked at me, and because I'm about 6 foot tall, bald, wearing a blue jacket, and he looked at me, and he went, "Cop." That was it. So I can never get drugs when I was in Brixton because I looked like a copper. Although once I will admit I did with a mate of mine, I did buy something. We've no idea what we bought. It was something. I think one day we bought some what appeared to be cork, and then another day my mate wanted me to get a pill for him. He wouldn't buy it himself, so I met this guy, got this random pill off this guy, gave it to my mate. No idea what it was. And he sat there and he took it, and nothing happened. And we were like, "What was it?" We've no idea what it was. It's probably like an angina tablet or something. Anyway, what are you going to do if you don't have a receipt? I'm going to ignore that bit. Trying to be really careful. Tell you what, let's skimp down a bit. I'm not going to tell you too much about the flat. Because we're going to get into that again soon. We're going to do the artwork. We're going to ignore that. Let's talk about Sally. Let's talk about Sally. Okay. Just Sally Rose White. In a lot of the documentation out there, it's weird, even in like some of the court documents, they say she was 31, but if you do your research properly, she's 38. So she's born in Southampton on the 23rd of September 1963, youngest daughter of Arthur and Muriel White. He was a computer expert. They said that when she was about 7 months old, they realised that she had developmental problems, and it was put down to brain damage, possibly owing to a lack of oxygen at birth. Up until the age of 16, so that's 1979, she was at a special school. Mid-1980s, they moved to Poole in Dorset. The family lived by the quay, so a nice place to live. And for a short period, everything was going well. She managed to hold down a job as a shop assistant. All of her employers were very supportive of, you know, her needs and understanding. But as she got older, as you can probably appreciate, you know, becoming an adult, wanted all of her friends going off, living new lives, getting married, getting their own flats, getting cars. And obviously, because she struggles a bit coping with life, you know, it's kind of harder for her. So they said she became more violent, quite badly behaved, struggled to hold down her jobs owing to her learning difficulties. She started running away from home and sleeping rough. Her father would obviously regular contact with the police, and they'd go out and search for her and bring her back home, but it would happen, it'd be a cycle, it would happen again. They tried their best to kind of do everything that was right for her, but you know, she wants her own independence. She can't appreciate the fact that she's having a swig of coffee. She's not having a swig of coffee, I'm having a swig of coffee. She can't appreciate that, you know, she needs someone to look after her, but she wants her independence. So you know what they did the best that they could. They gave her kind of enough of a leash so she could kind of be free and kind of kept an eye on her from a distance. So she moved to London, lived independently for a while. Her parents kind of, she got a small flat and a job, and, you know, her parents were kind of keeping an eye on her from a distance and, you know, trying to give her all the support that she needed, but she wanted to be independent. As mentioned, she became homeless. She was known around a lot of the Salvation Army hostels around that area. And she seemed to go into a spiral, so as you can appreciate, she's quite easily led by other people. She turned to cocaine, and she got into prostitution to fund that. So obviously, you know, if you think about it, she bumps into Tony Hardy, and he's, you know, 20 years older than her, bigger than her. He's got a big bushy beard. A lot of people who spoke to him said, you know, he does have a violent streak, but he does come across as incredibly charming and intelligent, and, you know, because he is intelligent as well. So he can be quite charming and polite and, you know, quite good fun to chat to as well. So we'll dive into that later on. I mentioned briefly about his friend, Maureen, who he had a long-term friendship with. And that's kind of interesting when you look at his relationship with women. So we'll dive into that a lot later on. But, the parents did really well to try and do the best that they could. But, you know, when Sally's life collapsed, she went into prostitution. It's kind of hard to find her. Her father was going back and forth from London, from Dorset to London. In the months leading up to that, trying to find her, going into homeless hostels, trying to find her. By that point, her parents were already living in Portugal, it's believed, by that point. So it made it even more difficult for them to do that. I'm guessing they were probably retired by that point. So last day she was seen was on the 19th of January 2002 at the Manor Society on 12 Melia Street in Bermondsey. It's still there today. It's a church of Our Lady of La Saleta and the Saint Joseph Catholic Church. It's part of the Slovak Catholic Mission in London. Sorry, it's got a long title. So it's a day centre. It's still there today. It's open from like 8:30 to 1:30. It's a brown brick church right at the back of the immigration service. And they kind of provide food and clothes and bedding and support for people. And, you know, it's a fantastic charity. So she was quite well known there. Likelihood is that Tony Hardy was known there. We'll get into this later on with his other stuff, but he was bounced around a lot of hostels in the 10 years that he was here, and he was known. I've met quite a few homeless people, and like I tried to get a homeless guy recently into a hostel. He was like, can you help me with some money? And I was like, no, because I don't do giving people money. But I was like, what are you looking for? You need to get into a hostel. He's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, well, I'll sort you out. So I had my laptop with me, and we going through all the hostels, and I was like, okay, look, there's a bed available here. He's like, oh, I can't do that one. I was like, why? He's like, oh, I've been kicked out of that one. Okay, we'll try this one. No, I'm not allowed back there. And it literally, we were going through, and it's like, I was going through a list of 20, and it was like, oh, what about this one? It was like, it's too far. And it's like, yeah, but it's the only place you can get in tonight. And it's like, it must be difficult if you've got mental health problems or drink problems, and you need a bed to stay in. You're trying to raise the, you're trying to raise like the £20 a night to stay in a hostel, and then, you know, because a lot of these charity ones are good, but they've only got limited beds. So yeah, it must be a real nightmare. So Sally was well known there. It's highly likely that Tony was. It was only by doing this research, because I've got this chronology and I put all these pieces together, and even though, like, a lot of the journalists on this, when they look at it, they just put down details. They go, he was here on this point, and you just go, okay, where is that place? Like, I don't know, let's invent somewhere, Bruno House. And they go, he walked out of Bruno House on the 12th. And you go, okay, well, where's Bruno House? So what I do is I go in and go, right, where's Bruno House? Where was it then? Is that correct? Find it. And here, that's why, when I was looking at this, when he left Rugby House, the detox centre, that's how I was able to work out where it was. Because I looked and it's just on the other side of London Bridge Station. Whereas Sally's regular place that she'd come to was the Manor Centre, which is just... So it's they're literally one street away. So the likelihood is he would have gone to that hostel. She definitely is. So they probably did know each other. We're not too sure. This is why I've kept it vague in there. Because we don't know. I would have loved to have written that they met that morning outside the Manor Centre, which they may have done. But we can't prove that. So I haven't put that in. But it's one of those. This is the problem with this story. There's some details that are very accurate. There are some details that are just, there's nothing on them. So I've got to leave it vague, unfortunately. But that's part of the interesting thing about the story of the Camden Ripper, is that because we'll go into this later on, but he gives no comment a lot, which is his legal right. No comment, no comment, no recollection. I don't remember this. But when he wants to, he can chat about stuff and he can keep talking. But other times, he's just no comment. We'll dive into this a lot later, but there's things where he just refused to talk. And now he's dead, we will never know. So that will make part four quite interesting now that he's snuffed it. So let's do the answers to the questions. Yeah, oh, that's because I've waffled too long. Right, question number one. Sally and Tony, what were their middle names? Her middle name was Rose, his middle name was John. Question two. How much did Tony state that he drank each day? It was, on average, 6 litres of Frosty Jack cider. Nice bit of research by me then. It's about £2, about just under £2 for a 2 litre bottle of 7.5% cider. It's pretty nasty. Question three. Tony was on 7 prescription drugs eventually by the end. What was he on for depression? He was on lithium. Question four. Who is Tony's serial killer hero? Mentioned in here. Jack the Ripper. Question number five. How many tellies, i.e. televisions, did Tony have? He had 3. Just for clarity, in this murder case, he only had 2 tellies, but later on he has 3 tellies. Although I haven't bothered to put that into this episode because it just confuses them. Why do we need to know that you had 2 then and bought another one later? It's, if I say 3 now and then we understand that it's to... So we understand this is kind of his shrine. Is his front room is kind of a shrine, a way he watches his pornography. Question number six. What was the name of the supported living accommodation that Tony got before his flat in Heartland? That was King's Terrace. Question number seven. Why did Tony jump out of the window at Ferndale Hotel? He thought that the special branch, i.e. coppers, evening, were after him for being a wanted killer. Interesting. Question eight. What were some of the things that Tony painted on his walls and doors? They were, you can name any of them, really. You don't need all of them. Fishes, pets, faces, names, seas, stars, and Celtic crosses. We'll dive into those quite in a detailed way later on. They're really fascinating. And if you're on Patreon, I've got loads of pictures of his artwork, so we'll put those on and we can have a good old gander at them. Question number nine. What was Sally's daughter's name who she put up for adoption? Her name was Louise. And question number 10. Which country did Tony previously live in and spent time in a psychiatric ward? It was Australia. Good. That's that done. So I hope you enjoyed that. We got three more episodes to go, and that will bring us up to Christmas Eve. What I'm thinking about doing, I might do a Christmas Day episode, just to kind of a welcome and Merry Christmas and all that episode. I'm probably I'm a bit windy now. Ooh, that was rude. Bacon sandwich. Ooh wee. Wow. Okay, that was nice. I'll probably do an omnibus episode as well, just because it's a four-parter and, you know, it kind of makes sense to put them out. And then that takes us to the end of the year when I can take a bit of a rest. So, hope you all well. Hope you all have a good week. Stay safe. Be good. Speak to you all soon. Lots of love. Okay, tatty bye. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.